This audio comes to you from the Science of Mind archives.
Someone who is no stranger presenting him, doesn't need to introduce. Saw Dr. McLean out here this morning and grabbed him off and asked him if he wouldn't come up and give us our lesson for the day out of the magazine, which he reluctantly consented, he said, but I think he was glad to do it because there's quite a little bit of ham in everyone who appears in the public, or they wouldn't be there. I'm glad to admit it. I only wish that I had two hams instead of one. But as you know, he is no stranger to any of us, and we are very happy to have him as our guest this morning, Dr. McLean.
Well, to be perfectly honest about it, I came here to get a boost from Dr. Holmes himself. Because every Sunday I'm either speaking to someone or to some group somewhere or else listening. I like to listen. I get a boost out of it. I don't learn anything new when I talk. I've heard the stuff before somewhere, it seems to me. But I came out here, and I know it would be better done if Dr. Holmes had it, if he gave this meditation. But I presume that most of you have had this lesson already for breakfast. This is a lesson for Sunday, April the 15th. I walk in and live in strength. If you haven't had that along with your cereal or your breakfast food this morning, I think you've missed something. It's quite a custom among our people to use this in the morning. I had my cereal and then I took it afterwards. I took this as a kind of a dessert for my breakfast this morning. And if you're not in the habit of eating a breakfast, I suggest that this is the best substitute I know. This is a very pertinent one. It lifted me and did me a great deal of good because I hadn't read it until this morning. I walk and live in strength. And it says here that man has too long submitted himself to the government of the race mind, to the belief that that the necessity of suffering for the soul's sake. Now, that's a very fine old idea. Many a fine minister has said that after he's been in the hospital because he's been abusing himself or overworking himself one way or the other, that God had to lay him on his back, you know, so he could look up and think. Now, that's a very fine poetic phrase, but it isn't scientifically true. It isn't necessary for people to suffer. And the idea that suffering is a discipline of the soul will not hold water. It'll not stand scientific tests. It's like the people who whale the daylights out of their children, you know, and thinking that punishment and cruelty that way will make a great soul out of them. Well, with all the returns in, it doesn't seem that that sort of punishment has ever made a great character yet. Consequently, we need to analyze many of these things that we have often believed in and eliminate that which is negative and try to get the opposite or the more positive or the more creative thought. Now, there's farther down in this paragraph here, this writer says that it's incredible that the universe should be operated on the basis of weakness, misery, and want. Well, that's so self-evident that it corrects us. It's incredible to think that the universe would necessarily be run on misery and want and lack. The universe is abundant and is pretty well put together, and its purpose is good. Because the purpose is the expression of God in the universe, which is the body of God. And it's a friendly universe. If any of you have dropped into the idea that the world is against you, and that people are talking about you, and that you haven't got a chance, and after all, when you were a child, you never had a chance to do very much, and so after all, you're limited and handicapped, you can believe that if you want to, but it just happens to be not true. You're a child of God. And the possibility of using divine wisdom and divine intelligence and divine strength is yours. It's a little trick to know how to tap the resources, but it's worth trying. So we should learn to know that the universe is not operated on the basis of weakness or misery or want, but operated on the basis of strength and power and beauty and supply. Now, this may have been our experience, but only because we have misused the power of God within us. When we begin to integrate ourselves with good by thought and deed, we will find it invincible. Now, the Spirit of God dwells in the inner man with power and might. The outer man reflects this Spirit insofar as the intellect allows it to come forth into expression. Now, that's from our textbook. The Spirit of God dwells in the inner man with power and might, and the outer man reflects the Spirit insofar as the intellect will allow it. I have a very dear friend who is a practitioner, and she goes to the hospital tomorrow. I have a feeling that she could have beat that game if she had not lost her grip a little bit. And I talked to her about it. I said, you didn't need to submit to all this. It may be a good thing. I'm not narrow on that. But she said, no, I know. I know. I lost my grip on it. I began to feel that there's something else had more power over me than I had over it. So we usually get the idea that I can't help this thing. It's too big for me. And you begin to admit at once that there is a power greater than you are, or greater than God within you. Now, that isn't true at all. And you may be a little bit timid sometime when you talk back to something that seems to have you and claim you for the time being. But say boo to start on and see if it isn't a coward, and see if you cannot break it down and disintegrate it, because you can by your own positive and creative and right thinking. So this morning we come now to try to give our minds a little bit of correction and to give them a little dry cleaning, to drop out that which is negative and to take on that which is creative and constructive. So let each of us turn within ourselves now and think in terms of creative thought, and let that be our guide, and let it find full fruitage and full expression within us. We know that God is everywhere, and this is somewhere, right where we are now. There is a presence here, and that presence is God. And we call it the presence because in it there is all the love and all the peace and all the intelligence and all the energy and all the power and all the know-how and all the substance and the methods and the materials for anything that we will ever need. That is within us, and it is surrounding us, around us, and we are immersed within it, and it is ours for the asking. Asking seems to be one of the golden keys of releasing good. Ask and you shall receive. Many of the things we need, we do not get because we do not ask for them. And sometimes in our passion, we clamor and ask and demand, and we receive not. Jesus explained that by saying, you ask and receive not because you ask amiss. And we pause to find out what's wrong with our method, what's wrong with our approach. When we ask and we do not receive, we would try to find out just where we were slipping up on it. All the good is available, the presence of God and the power of God. And when we here in this congregation now deliberately and intelligently seek and inquire and ask for the peace of God, then we have the integrity of the Almighty at stake, for God has never failed to answer a prayer yet. Any righteous prayer, any well-formulated, honest prayer receives an answer. The universe is so put together, and no treatment ever fails. It may not show as we think it will, but it will always succeed, because there is a power in this universe that keeps its own integrity. Therefore, we ask for the peace of God. And if the peace of God becomes our experience, there is no conflict, there is no confusion, there's no frustration whatsoever. So when we want our souls to be calm and our viewpoints to be clear, we pray intelligently and positively and believingly for the peace of God. We ask for the love of God. We ask for that nature of God to be manifest within us. It is like fresh water to our thirsty souls. We drink water out of the tap, and we don't know how many chemicals have been put into it, and we sometimes wonder what the water would taste like if we got it fresh from the spring in the mountains. Therefore, we pause right now to know, to wonder what it would be like to have the love of God, pure and undefiled and unadulterated, flow in upon us, that we might measure all the things that we call love by the love of God. And we pause now and ask for that manifestation of God within us, the love of God. It's warm, sweet, tender, and easily to be entreated. It heals, it empowers, it gives strength. we recognize our bodies to be the temple of the living Spirit Almighty. God is in the inner man. The Spirit is the inner man seeking to express itself in the outer man. And we try with all of our mental discipline to avoid thinking anything that would interfere with the full, free, perfect expression of that image of the inner man in all of our outward affairs. Therefore, we pause to let the Divine Spirit make the corrections within us, that which is not good for us, that which does not belong, shall fall away. And we tap the resources of strength and we feel renewed, for we become the object of God's manifestation and the center of His power and of His love and His peace. And for this we're very grateful. We're grateful that the Father is so near. We lift up our hearts in love and genuine thanksgiving and sincere gratitude to the Spirit of life, God, our Father, for all of His manifestations and His blessings. We count them over and over again and know with gratitude that they have come from the only source of supply there is, and that is our Father. This is the truth, and we accept it, and we know it to be the truth in our lives. Let us unite in the saying of the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, in earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and deliver us from evil, for thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever. Amen.
Thank you, Henry. It's always wonderful to appear on the platform with Dr. McLean. He's one of the grandest persons I have ever known, and has the tolerance and the understanding for life that comes only with having lived a lot of life. You know, the late Count Keiserling, who before the war used to receive students in classes in Europe, would not take anyone under 40 years of age. He said they weren't grown up enough. They weren't adult enough. They hadn't had enough experience to know what it was all about. Well, I don't know whether that's right or not, but I'm considerably older than that, because this year marks the 40th year of almost continuous, except for vacation, active Sunday morning audience participation, I guess we'll call it. It's been a thing of joy. And now, taking you to my conference, is drawing this particular phase of it to a close. Beginning the 1st of June, Dr. Emmett Clark, Gene Emmett Clark, will be speaking here Sunday mornings. And early in the fall, we're going to do something that hundreds of you have wanted to have done, I haven't been able to do, and that is form a local chapter. We call them Affiliated Churches of the Beverly Hills Group. It ought to have been done a long time ago, but it's furnished me such a wonderful audience to speak to, the finest I have ever had in my life. At no place here in California or any other place in the United States have I ever spoken to so intelligent, responsive a group. Somebody said to me just this morning, I like coming here, but I was terribly shocked because you permitted people to applaud. My answer was, if the time ever comes they don't want to, I shall quit. For so long, we have separated life from living, religion from everyday life, our philosophy from anything that's natural, that they are like accessories to be worn or used only semi-occasionally. I have enjoyed this ministry here in Beverly Hills beyond anything I have ever done in my life, and certainly would not wish to pass it over even to a person like Gene Emmett Clark, who is the first person we ever had during the years I've been out here, who during the summer vacation got more people, he left with more people than he started with. He shows he's very good, doesn't it? It's the first time it's ever happened. I don't know whether this compliment to myself or a greater one to Gene, but he did that last summer, and that delighted me so much. He is the best equipped to take this place of anyone we have in the entire field, and you will be delighted with him. We find that we need a church school, a junior church, and a high school out here. It's continuous demand for it, and that means someone who has a local headquarters, midweek meetings, offices, a place for everyone locally to go to, which we have sadly lacked, which we will have starting with this fall. Now, I know you rejoice with me in the thought that I expect to be able to move from this into something not better, because nothing can be as good as this has been. This is it, so far as I am concerned. When you have an audience like this, and you're free to say anything you want to, provided something you cannot get arrested for saying, and I'm very careful about that, you will never know what restraint I hold myself in. But it's only on that account. It isn't because of morals or ethics, because they are pretty local and geographical and historic. As Tennyson said, new truth makes ancient good uncouth. There was a time when people in the South even thought that Negroes perhaps did not have a soul, and that it was God's will that they should be slaves. Well, you know, in India they had the caste system. They still have it. Gandhi did a lot to break it down. But it was an economic thing. Some smart guy made up his mind he didn't want to milk the cows. So he invented the caste system to get somebody who thought that he was born because of a previous incarnation, so he had to milk the cows. Brother, I don't want to do that to this beautiful audience, but I'd have a great advantage over you if I could make it stick, which thank God I couldn't. I mean, the moment I announced it, I dropped dead with laughter, and as you bore the remains out, you would be in hysterics. And if we ever lose that kind of humor, then God forbid that we shall be permitted to stay any longer on this earth. Let's go where it's hotter or colder, and we wake up or go to sleep forever. There is nothing equal common sense. It's a very interesting thing to me that at last there is a certain portion of the world becoming liberated from the fear and the superstition which has been handed down by the ages of ignorance. So completely so that in the Christian theology it had the fall and the redemption and sin and salvation, and in the Eastern, the renunciation, which Buddha himself said was necessary because all trouble are troubles of the ego. Let it become non-existent and it won't have any trouble. I think that's very good logic, but it's a false one, like our own guilt complexes. And now at last I feel that there is an audience, very large, very eager, and I've had a great desire to tackle this proposition. Whatever age I get will be an adventure if it's the last day of my life. The moment the adventure toward the unknown, the moment the zest of the inquiry is over, we are dead. As the explorer said, this is a man who sought perpetual adventure. Says he goes up one trail where it runs out and stops. He must always find a new horizon, and he said, I think magnificently, something lost behind the border, something missing, go and find it, something lost behind the border, something missing, go ye there. Thought of that when I read The Search After the Little Murphy Girl. Now, she's a sweet and gentle soul, but I thought then, when it is finally known what the reach of the mind is, it's only guessed at now, only a few people realize it. Anybody can remember anything that ever happened to anybody who ever lived. And if they were in a clairvoyant state, so they visualize the thought, they will see it transpiring as though it were still going on. And if they were in a prophetic state of what is called precognition, they could see what would happen to it as it continues to go on. But there is no fate in it. They are merely reading the time track of the past and seeing into the future, because the Alpha, the Omega, that is the end, is in the Alpha, the beginning. It is no different than somebody going out in the garden and say, well, let's see, out in the hen house. They don't have hen houses anymore. You see what? Dates me. We used to have hen houses, and we used to set hens when I was a kid. They don't do it that way anymore. But suppose it was my childhood, and I was setting a hen. That means you put some eggs under them. They're already sitting and waiting, kind of hopeful-like. And somebody comes out and says, well, I see you're setting this kind of eggs. At 21 days from now, you'll get Plymouth Rock chickens. Now, nobody can see a Plymouth Rock chicken around the hen or under it or in the egg. And yet that prophecy will be true, but it would also be true if at the end of the 10th day we took the eggs out and broke them. Now, this is the time track between the setting of the hen, where she squats over a dozen to 13 eggs, and the 21st day, when by a process of creative nature, the eggs shall have matured into chickens. There is nothing fatalistic about it. The reach of the human mind is a terrific thing. Some time ago last year, a very close friend of my wife and myself left this world without any regret, although her friends regret her departure. And I was very interested to learn upon the return from our vacation last summer that she had left to my wife and myself to dispose of as we saw fit, quite a little considerable sum of money to use for whatever purpose we thought would be at that time the best. And we talked it over and decided perhaps the best contribution this could make would be at least a 6 month or a year's tryout. It's enough they had to pay for 6 months. Very expensive. Now, I bet you guess what it is, television program. Now, this is the greatest medium in the world today. There isn't anything that can compare with it. In the 3 years that I talked over the network here, Sunday afternoons, this thing called life, we had over 600,000 letters come in from the Pacific Coast, and the majority of them right from Southern California. So early in the fall, by the 1st of September, I'm going to start that experiment Sunday afternoon, but sometime between 4 and 6. 30-minute program of just getting up and talking. We can tell in 13 weeks whether we should continue or not. But we decided that in memory of our sweet friend, that probably this money would do a great deal more good there than it would for us to keep it or to spend it for some other purpose. Shows how little people in our field think of money. It's not an entity. The moment anybody has discovered what money is for and knows that it's a commodity and knows that you only need a certain amount of that kind of a commodity, that moment their possessions no longer possess them or obsess them. Emerson said, cast everything you have on the four winds of heaven. Well, that's what we're going to do. And I know you'll all be thinking for us and praying and affirming, because I am not going to do it any differently on the air than I do it here. I wouldn't do it if I had to. You can only be yourself. Imitation is suicide. And I have found there are always enough people who take me as I am, thank God. There are always a lot of people who think the way you do. Isn't that wonderful? And I have discovered another thing in life, that all of our great religions were invented by interesting people, generally sound fundamentally, and that at first they were rejected by everyone around them. They crucified Jesus because the Romans were afraid that he would usurp the power of Rome. They made Socrates drink the hemlock bark because they were afraid that he was arousing the youth of Athens to freedom. Always when new things come, the religious say it contradicts the Bible and is a heresy. See the anathemas that were hurled at Mrs. Eddy, one of the truly great prophets of the world. I admire her consistency and persistency beyond that of most any other character in America. I don't agree with all the things or I'd be in that field, but that has nothing to do with it. A great and a true prophet. And I remember reading only about 40 years ago where, this is very funny, I shouldn't say it. It is not critical, but it is critical. You know, in our field, we no longer have any right to criticize, but brother, the way we can analyze it is something out of this world. Criticism is a piker. A man who very shortly afterward became a bishop in a certain denomination wrote a little book, and when he said the time would come when this Christian Science movement would be destroyed and all their pagodas would be upside down in hell, it's a picturesque language, to say the least. Well, that's the way it is. New ideas are rejected by the orthodox as contradictory to the Bible, blasphemous. They're rejected by the scientific as being beyond rationality, and by most of the philosophies of that age as not being logical because they don't agree with their patterns. Then a few people espouse the cause, and a few more, and a few more. And by, no one contradicts it, and they are all held to be valid. There was a time when there was legislation in Congress against the Mormons. There was a time when spiritualists were held in disrepute. Well, let's go back a little further. There was a time when what they did to the Christians was something. Like the little boy who came home from from this picture showing the persecution of the early Christians in the arena where the lions ate them. And he came home crying. His mother said, I knew my little darling's heart would be touched with tenderness when she saw what happened to the early Christians and he was bawling. She said, there, Johnny, don't feel so badly. Don't feel so badly, darling. It's all right. Oh, he says, it ain't all right, Mama. He says, those poor lions. He says, there weren't Christians enough to go around. And so you see, it's all in the viewpoint. Well, at any rate, we're going to try it, and I'm very happy about it. Now, our talk this morning is the mind at mischief. And we are talking about the human mind. God's mind is never at mischief. God never made a mistake. God never rejected anybody. God never cursed anything. God never destroyed anything. God does not dislike anyone. He is of too pure an eye to behold evil and cannot look upon iniquity. But there is a law of mind in action which by the very nature of our being we are compelled to accept. It's a psychological law. But it goes much farther than most people realize. And we call it the action between the conscious intelligence and the subjective creative receptivity to it. We are all made up of our thoughts. It is now known, definitely, that somewhere between 75% to 90% of all diseases are unconscious creations of the human mind. Now, that does not mean that they're unreal. I cannot personally tolerate any philosophy that denies something merely because it doesn't like it. We do get sick, and we scratch because we itch, and we cry because we feel bad. I don't think we have to deny that. It is known that 85% of our accidents are unconsciously entertained. It is now believed by psychiatrists that the man or the woman who just gets married and divorced merely has a neurotic thought pattern which causes him or her unconsciously to choose somebody as a mate with whom he or she cannot get along. My gosh. I've been married for 30 years. Somebody said to me the other night, well, when you and your wife have disputes, I said, period, we don't. After 30 years, if I said to her what you should do, or she said to me what we should do, we would both fall dead. It is possible for people to live in harmony and still have disagreements. We don't have to each believe alike. She says, I don't think that's true. And I said, no, I don't believe that would work out. But that's it. That's the nearest to an argument we ever had. Now, it may be that the only felicity domestically is one where there must be a serious eruption every few moments. Like the boy who was hitting himself over the head with a hammer, and his mother said, well, Johnny, why do you do that? He said, it feels so good when I stop. Now, that may make sense, but I don't follow it. It's rather a vicarious, it's a hard way to get pleasure out of life. It is known that 85% of our accidents are unconsciously invited. Man who wrote The Will to Live said that everybody decides not only when he's going to die, but what from. It's a doctor. In the Fareed Holmes Clinic, which I believe is the most interesting, fascinating thing that is being started in America today to put together medicine philosophy, religion, everyday conduct, and psychology, prayer and pills, or whatever you need. Thinks the most intelligent start. I don't know what it'll ultimate in, but it will be something, I think, terrific as the years go on. We're finding, too, that there is a terrific liability of negative thought with every disease, with every unhappiness, with every neurosis. Now, I would like to just very briefly explain, in about 2 minutes, what the fundamental cause back of this is and what the theory is that is held in common by every school of psychology in the world. It's been a subject that's interested me, and I think I have a little knowledge of the subject. But to synthesize, put together what they've all found, and we'll have this. Now remember, this is so simple that's going to be hard to accept, but if you remember it, I don't care what book on psychiatry or analysis or psychological counseling you ever read, you will find that this is the basis of it. Everything else is filled in to elaborate on these few simple things. Man is born with an intense desire and feeling to create. He can't help it. Now that's been called the id by somebody. Freud, I guess, means the it. The passage of that original creativity through him has been called the libido, L-I-B-I-D-O, which is defined as the emotional craving for self-expression back of all things, the repression of which leads to psychoneurosis. Man is born with a desire and the imperative need, the demand to create. Create or die. There is a pressure against everything, an emotional pressure to live. Now this is called the libido. Now the first law of the libido is that it must have an object. Whoever wrote that song, what was it, to love something? Well, I can't think of it. The libido must have an object. Love must love something. Creativity must make something. The child makes a mud pie. The man grows up and builds the Golden Gate Bridge. The child makes up little stories and little lies, and we ought to let him do it. We're older and make up bigger ones with more experience. And that's the only difference. If he's good, when he grows up, he'll write fiction. But if that stops right there, then he has a sense of guilt. He becomes frustrated. All frustration is the pushing back of this creative energy into the unconscious, as they call it, back in the mind. First law of the libido is it must have an object. The first law of the ego is it must not be rejected, must be accepted. Jesus said, neither do I condemn thee. He knew all of these things, but with such a simplicity. It is done unto you as you believe. Most profound statement ever made. Metaphysically, spiritually, religiously, theologically, and psychologically, but it is so simple that it will take 10 lifetimes, perhaps, to find the complete significance of it. Now, you see, thought is creative, and the more feeling there is in it, the more creative it is. Therefore, when thought does no longer flow through into expression, but is crowded back into the unconscious, a dynamic creative energy is buried alive. Freud said that a repression, psychological repression, is a group of highly emotionally charged thoughts, feelings, and ideas so deeply repressed into the subconscious, the unconscious, that they are buried there and cannot be brought to the surface by an act of will or through the imagination. But he said, where they remain in a dynamic state. The corpse is not a corpse. This is the nature of the inner conflict. It is making lots of trouble. Now the trouble it makes is what is called the inner conflict. And the inner conflict is always that body of our emotional reaction, which didn't get out here into fruition, was shoved back here while there's still the pressure always to do it. We all want it. And in between the pressure from the cosmos and the repressing back from the individual, which is unconscious, is this thing remaining in a dynamic state and is called the inner conflict. And at the core of this, which is also called a neurosis, there are always, according to Karen Horney, who was one of the greatest living authorities, in her book called The Nature of the Inner Conflict, four things: rejection, guilt, insecurity, and anxiety. These are the emotional repressions. No confidence. They gradually assume such a gigantic proportion that the unconscious, now the negative, this body of thought back in here that's all dressed up and got no place to go, begins to argue and dominate and control the intellect. And when it reaches its ultimate, that's insanity. The prerogatives of, but we're all crazy somewhere. Now then, that which ought to have been creative, that which ought to have brought peace and joy and prosperity and happiness, now produces negation. But because there is such a sense of guilt attached to it, we project this guilt into others and in the universe to relieve ourselves of tension. This is where the idea of renunciation came in the East. You mustn't do anything that you'd get any pleasure out of, because you'll come back by another reincarnation and be poked harder into the mud. It's all nonsense. But we're just as silly. It's where our idea of the fall and redemption, sin and salvation, and all the things that they've made up about what happens to you. It always amazes me when they tell me what happens, how far these boys have traveled. They've had great opportunities, which were not given to all of us. I don't know why. But you know, all I have to say about it is, it ain't so. Because they made it up, and I can make up a better one. And a more happy and intelligent and sane one. And God must be sane. So thought, the mind is one mind, and it's now shown, and I think it will be a great lesson, because it will teach us the meaning of the non-violence of Gandhi and the non-resistance of Jesus. To me, they are the two greatest single spiritual teachers I know anything about. They taught pretty much the same thing relative to this. Resist not evil and it will flee from you. The nonviolence of India that did something that all of the generations of objective opposition never did. A power which is terrific. Now let's take this in our individual life. We are either making ourselves sick or well all the time. We can't help it. The power that we use is entirely neutral, plastic, and impersonal. Then somebody says, well, doesn't God care? We're not talking about God. We're talking about the law of mind and action. Maybe it's an attribute of God. When we plant marijuana seed, we'll get marijuana. People get hepped up on it. Beside it, we can plant a cucumber seed and be as cool as a cucumber. The creative soil does not say, this is good or bad. If I put a thought into my mind that says I'm poor, weak, lonely, miserable, unhappy, everybody hates me and I hate everybody else, which we're liable to do, unwittingly, we are doing something to our mind which will attract negative things to us objectively, accidents, divorces, and we are carrying around with us the seat and the seed of most of our diseases, and we are taking the possibility of happiness and making misery out of it. There is nothing in heaven or hell other than what we've put there. I myself am heaven and hell. Now somebody will say, well, why does God permit it? I don't know. I am not God. It's an awful good thing I'm not, because people with whom I disagree wouldn't be safe. And it's a good thing that there is an integrity beyond mine, or I wouldn't be safe myself. And so I feel that we are individuals, have the right to self-choice, until by trial and error or intuition or wisdom or something we learn what is right. That we shall remain individuals, it looks that way. The ancients did not have the conveniences that modern science has equipped modern civilization with, but the laws of nature would have provided them had they have known about them. It doesn't seem strange to me that at last we're getting more close to that final creativity in our own consciousness that is the arbiter of our fate. That decides whether we're going to be happy or unhappy, probably mostly sick or well, accidents, and I believe prosperous or in adversity. I believe everything is mind, ultimately. God is infinite mind. I agree with Jeans that God is an infinite thinker, thinking mathematically. Now, if we put that in our own mind, it says our thoughts are creative and they have a mathematics. Correll said that faith follows a law like mathematics. And Eddington said that we can think of law as intelligence acting as law. There is a law of mind in action. And if we use it negatively, it will destroy, but the same force will create. Now, the trouble with most of us in our field is we're trying to find a good to overcome an evil, a God to kick the devil out, a heaven to cool off hell, and you'll never find it. There is only one power, but two ways to use it. You see, we've only got one mind, fortunately, but if we use it negatively, it produces a negative result. God isn't doing evil to us. That's the only way we can do it right at that time. Then we will reverse the process and the change will be brought about. Now that's what we're learning to do. But we must not think that we're bringing a good to contest an evil. Because as long as we do that, we'll have an eternal combat. That has been the great fallacy of theology. They have, out of their morbid imagination, fallaciously, created an evil that's almost equal to the good in which we all believe. Now, they haven't done it maliciously. They just didn't see that there can only be one power in the universe but two ways to use it. Let us accept it. This we know about the creative function of the mind. If then we could know that the power that made us sick could heal us, and that all we would have to do is to reverse the way we use it, we should have the tool in our hand to relieve ourselves of the burden of our psychosomatic diseases, which are most of them. If we knew that a certain way of thinking could produce a certain result, and an opposite way could produce an opposite result, and that we're really not fighting this power, it's just responding, it's fluidic. The nature of the unconscious or the subconscious or the subjective or this creative medium is that it is plastic and neutral and impersonal and pretty much accepts what you give it, but it reasons only deductively. It doesn't rationalize or reason as a conscious mind does. And therefore, like the soil of the ground, it receives the impress of thought and acts upon it as though it were true. Now, if this is true, we shall find that which seems to be at war within us, that which is arguing toward the negative and bringing up out of our repressions and complexes, the anxiety and the insecurity and the fear and the uncertainty.
For more spiritual content like this, visit scienceofmindarchives.com.